I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Gerald Chertavian, founder of Year Up, an organization that provides a one-year intensive job training and internship program to low-income young urban adults 18 to 24 years old. Year Up enrolls close to 2,000 students per year, and roughly 400 organizations have hired Year Up students as interns or permanent employees since its inception in 2000. Prior to launching Year Up, Gerald was an internet entrepreneur. His company, Conduit Communications, was sold for $80 million in 1999. Gerald is a graduate of Bowdoin College and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jessica.
You've had a career in business prior to launching Year Up. You worked at Chemical Bank, now part of J.P. Morgan Chase, and you helped to turn around an internet company. Yet you've been civic-minded from an early age. For instance, in college at Bowdoin, you joined a Big Brother, Big Sister program. Where did this sensibility come from?
You know, I remember the day I was in the mailroom at Bowdoin and went to my mailbox, and there was a flyer and talked about the Big Brothers program. And I think maybe being the youngest of two and always wanting someone to take care of, to look after, it struck me as a great thing to get involved with. And that was my first experience and absolutely loved it. And in many ways, it changed my life by introducing me to a young boy in New York City who ultimately became the inspiration for Year Up.
You were at Bowdoin. Now, this is in Maine, yet the Big Brothers program that you connected with, was that in Maine?
Yes, it was in Maine, and the young boy I was matched with lived in a, what we called, I guess, a trailer park in Maine. And I remember one weekend his mom said, would you mind watching my son because I have to do some things? I thought she meant for a few hours. That was the whole weekend.
You grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, and your family is from Armenia. There were lots of mills in Lowell, and many of the mills were connected to making products made of wool.
Mm-hmm.
But your grandfather was allergic to wool.
He unfortunately started in the mills and realized that being allergic to wool, the mills probably weren't his industry of choice, and ended up buying a very small shoeshine business and cobbler business that he literally worked at 7 days a week for probably 50 years and never took a day off. And I remember that he put four children through college working as a cobbler. My own father, when he came back from World War II, through the GI Bill, was able to go to Tufts Dental School.
While you were growing up in Lowell, Massachusetts, you had a number of jobs. What were some of those?
Well, my dad believed that work was something to be started early in life. So I have done everything from bus tables to pump gas to run an ice cream counter to work at a golf course. At one point, I drove high-risk young people around the city on a work duty for the summer. They were about 16 years old. And we went around the city and did work duty, kind of raking and cleaning up the city. And every time I left the van, they would try to take it. Or they'd say, Gerald, stop the car at the grocery store. And I'd stop and they'd come running out, having stolen a bunch of stuff. And I said, you know, what are you guys doing? They said, look, man, we got to eat. We got no money. And but I did say I fell in love with them. And that was another experience I had that I realized I need to be working with young people because I just get huge energy out of it.
Just as your Year Up students have internships for 6 months, you too had an internship or two in your day. Can you describe one or two of them?
One summer internship I had that was a little bit more like the Year Up summer internships. I worked in Washington and wrote about 40 letters. Only one person responded and gave me an unpaid internship in Washington for a lobbyist. And I remember so well because a gentleman said to me, Joe, could you please write a memo? And I looked at him and I said, I'm sorry, sir, I don't know what a memo is. And he looked at me and he kind of growled. And he said, it goes to, from, date, and re. And then you draw a line and you write a memo. And I said, wow, no one ever told me that before. And then you think about the parallel to our young adults today, not knowing what some of these basic professional things are. And luckily, someone taught me when I was 18 in Washington in an internship. And that's where I learned what a memo was.
The seed for Year Up, you said, was inspired by your little brother. His name is David Heredia, who is living in New York. He's from the Dominican Republic. Talk about the nature of your relationship with David.
So David, I remember the day I met David in the social worker, a caseworker from Big Brothers, brought us into the housing complex on the Lower East Side. And I remember riding the rickety elevator up to the 18th floor. And those, you know, elevators are kind of dirty. They don't smell that good. And I remember walked in the door, and it was a tiny little apartment. Probably six folks were living there. And tried to speak Spanish as best I could. David's mom doesn't speak English that well. I remember kind of falling in love with this beautiful young 10-year-old boy right away. What I didn't realize is he looked at me and said, "Oh, my goodness, a white guy. I have no idea what to expect. I actually have never had a relationship with someone like this." David's, you know, over the years, you know, I do treat him very similarly to my biological children. And he's now married. He's got two beautiful children, a third almost on the way in the next few weeks. He's college educated, went for the School for Visual Arts. He runs his own animation company. And so I really saw that here's this beautiful, hungry, motivated young man, and wanted so bad just for him to realize his potential.
It's always hard to think about the counterfactual, but how do you think you changed the trajectory of his life?
So as David would say himself, he would have done okay somehow. What he said is, Gerald exposed me to things, whether they were experiences, networks, connections, helped me navigate things like higher education. Indeed, we're blessed to help support his education financially. But David was a good man who was going to make it. So I'm very suspect of the idea that anyone changes someone's life. I think you can give someone opportunity, and then they can take control of their lives the way they want to. And it's to us at Year Up always been a respectful way to look at what we're doing.
You were a big brother to him since the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? Was it a daily interaction you had with him, a weekly one?
I spend every Saturday of my life with David, and I was religious about it. And we'd spend the whole day together. And I'd bringing my thoughts, "David, do you want to play basketball or baseball?" And he'd say, "No, I just want to draw." So from day one, we'd go to the art store and buy pens and pencils and crayons, and he would draw. And I, to this day, I can see an image of David sleeping with paper on his chest as he's been drawing incessantly with ideas and creativity throughout the night, and then finally just passed out from being so tired.
You mention in your book that when you live in Boston, but when you come to New York City from the airport, you ask the taxi driver to drive past his house on the FDR Drive just so you could see his old apartment and remember the seed of Europe.
Absolutely. Every taxi I take that goes in and out of New York City, we go by David's apartment. I can see the exact window where his apartment is. You know, when you dedicate your life to this type of work, it's so important to always connect with why do you do this. And for us, it's about social and economic justice. And all of that started in that little window in that apartment in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a social entrepreneur, Gerald Chertavian. He's the founder of Year Up, a workforce development program that teaches technical and professional skills to disadvantaged young adults. Year Up then places its students into internships and full-time jobs at leading corporations. David was the inspiration for your starting Year Up, but it took you a decade or so before you actually launched it. But proof that you actually had the idea was in your application to Harvard Business School, where you wrote about starting an organization committed to workforce development. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. I remember writing that essay. I was working at Chemical Bank at the time. And honestly, I didn't have a copy of it because it was in the 80s. We were writing on old typewriters. But one day I got a letter from Harvard Business School. This was probably 2005. And in it was a copy of the original document that I had written on the old typeface. And it was from the director of admissions at Harvard Business School. And he said, basically, "You done good, kid. You did what you said you were going to do."
Prior to going to Harvard Business School, you worked at Chemical Bank. What did you do for Chemical Bank?
So I worked in what was then called the Financial Services Division. And we were approving the credit for folks doing things like interest rate swaps and FX deals. And at that point, people didn't really understand a lot of the credit risk inherent in those transactions. What was critical about Chemical Bank was my boss. My original gentleman who hired me, Doug George, really gave me my chance. You know,
What do you mean?
Well, I came down to Wall Street to interview at Morgan Stanley, at Solomon Brothers, at all these places. And you know what? I didn't know anything about finance. My dad was a dentist. And so as I went into these interviews, kind of green, I probably didn't have the right color suit on. I hadn't had all that training. And so I was leaving New York City with my kind of tail between my legs saying I didn't get a job. My sister-in-law had worked for Doug George back in the earlier 80s. Said, well, before you leave, just talk to this gentleman. I went and met with him. He said, you know what? You should apply for a job here. I did. I got hired. I'm sure I had a leg up, a year up in Doug George. And then he asked me to come work with him in the division he was starting at Chemical called Financial Services Division, which is now significant.
Now, luckily, you had somebody like him to latch on to. But outside of that relationship, did you feel fulfilled in the work you were doing?
So finance for me was always incredibly intellectually stimulating and fulfilling, and I love economics. But I always knew there was a bit of a void from the meaningful aspect. So I knew it was intellectually stimulating, but it didn't kind of make my soul smile.
After Chemical Bank and Harvard Business School, you ended up turning around a software development internet company called Conduit Communications. You and your wife invested $80,000 in 8% of the company, and the company grew to over 130 employees, $20 million in revenue, and you sold Conduit in 1999 for $80 million. Interestingly, you sold all of your shares in a single trade, feeling the internet bubble. Can you talk to me about just the boisterous nature of that time period?
If one recalls back in the 99, there was such an amount of exuberance in the market. And when we sold that organization, we knew it was what we were paid for. It was probably more than it was worth. And so we looked at each other and we said a sentence which to me sticks in my mind, which is bulls and bears make money, pigs get slaughtered. And so at that point, we really knew that it was valued probably too highly. We decided it was time to cash out, so to speak. And I remember I had one block trade for those shares. And I remember the gentleman, one of my close friends, who's a block trader, who helped me do it. And he kind of clicked on his phone, and then he just clicked back to me and said, you're done. Hmm. And I knew at that point that what that meant was I had a chance to now start year up. And for me, it was not I'm done. It's your beginning on a different journey. And I don't for a minute think that all the good times we had in the 90s were down to brains or brilliant anything. We were fortunate.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gerald Chertavian, founder of Year Up. We'll hear more from Gerald coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Gerald Chertavian, founder of Year Up, an organization that provides a one-year intensive job training and internship program to low-income young urban adults 18 to 24 years old. Now, you founded Year Up, and your wife, Kate, was supportive from the get-go. For instance, you knew you wouldn't accept any income for the first 10 years, although the board insisted after 6 years that you earn an income. How did you meet Kate, by the way?
So Kate and I met surreptitiously in Cambridge, although I was living in New York City and she was living in London. We both traveled via plane to the same party on St. Patrick's Day 1990 in Cambridge, of all places, Cambridge, Massachusetts. We met, we knew we connected, and I remember I faxed her, these were in the days of faxes, and said, come meet me in Thailand in 4 months. Which she had the courage to do. And after 2 weeks together, we decided we were going to get married.
And the facts came after just a couple hours of meeting her. After.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She decided she had to have a picture of me because, you know, 4 months after you've only known someone for a few hours, you kind of forget what they look like. So she got off the plane with a photo so she could identify me in the Thai airport in Bangkok.
So you decided to launch Year Up, and I want to talk about those early days. What was harder for you in the beginning? What comes to mind?
We had lived in London for almost 10 years when I was running with my partners Conduit Communications. So when we moved back here, although I'd gone to business school in Boston, I really didn't have a network. So I was so fortunate. A gentleman, Craig Underwood, said one day when I talked to him, what can I do to help you? I said, well, you are, you know, a partner at Bain & Company. You know all these people. Can you just get me like 10 meetings? And he literally chased down everyone he knew, walked with me to every meeting, said, here's a guy I trust and I believe in. Will you give him a chance?
And these are people who could provide financial as well as operational support around Boston.
That's right. Largely the internships that they provided for our young people, which got us out of the gate. So it was hard to make those connections. And also, we didn't have any proof points. So when people said, have you done this before? No. Gerald, have you ever started a school before? No. Have you ever run a nonprofit? No. Have you ever taught anyone these skills? No. Why am I to trust you? And we said, if it doesn't work, don't pay us. Don't contribute to us. Right. You know, pay us on results.
A lot of these internships started out as internet-oriented internships, and you needed to kind of pivot ultimately to larger corporations.
That's right. Just by quick kind of context, students spend 6 months in training, then 6 months in an internship, and that makes their 1 year, hence the name Year Up, a year that they move up. We sold all those first internships to the Science and Viance and, you know, the internet companies of the day. And unfortunately, they all called me up and said, our business is now imploding. We can't do this. So we quickly changed to teach folks what is called desktop support or help desk support, how you support technology. And then it was leaders in the Boston community who gave us a chance to place students into those jobs.
How about the challenges that you faced with the young adults, these 18 to 24-year-olds? I mean, overall, they come from very disadvantaged backgrounds. But can you provide an example of what that means on a granular level?
Sure. I was listening to just a young man the other day, and he spoke at graduation. And each community at Europe names themselves, right? They have a name. The name of this community was Go Hard or Go Home. And he gave a speech at graduation. He said, you know, for me, having grown up in 18 different homes and having lived in shelters, I knew I had no option to go home, so I had to go hard.
A lot of these students, you mentioned that one or some of them might have gotten shot at one point or...
So many of our students, very sadly, have been very close to violence. I would say there's barely a student we serve who hasn't had a close friend, family member involved in a shooting or a homicide. Sadly, many of our students will show signs of trauma from having experienced really tough and violent neighborhoods. And we've very sadly lost a few of our students to violence over the years. I can remember one young man at 3:30 in the afternoon, he was handing in his paper, you know, with a smile on his face and an expert in technology. And at 5 o'clock, someone shot him 5 times in the back. And he was not in a gang. He was not involved in criminal activity. But he was at the wrong place at the wrong time in a very violent neighborhood, which had gang wars. And so he was of an ethnicity that was on one side of that gang war.
The people who come to Europe, these people are motivated to want to join your program. You still face, though, issues with motivation and time management, for example. Time management is a big issue for you. What exactly does that mean?
So we know that to keep a knowledge-based job today, you've got to show up on time. You've got to have a great attitude. You've got to be a team player. You have to communicate well. And so a lot of our students, our young adults, haven't actually had an opportunity to learn what we call the ABCs, attitudinal, behavioral, and communication skills that you need to hold a job at Google or Goldman Sachs or the federal government. And so what we do is really focus hard on helping young people learn those skills, which are called non-cognitive skills, which you can learn pretty quickly. And that's we've been complimented many, many times that our students have better professional skills than a college graduate who's never really learned what does it take to exist in a corporate environment.
We talked before about the challenge in getting corporations to provide internships. What about recruitment of the first class at Europe? How was that?
Boy, the first class was certainly harder than the 101st class, I'll tell you that. The challenge is if you say you're going to earn money while you learn, you're going to get taught by great teachers, and we're going to give you an internship, a lot of folks said, too good to be true. What's the catch? So we had to really prove that we were authentic and we delivered what we said. And now, once we get going in a community, it's probably 70% word of mouth.
These candidates for the first class, they showed up at the Hancock Tower in Boston, which is a prominent feature in the Boston skyline. Many of these candidates had never been to an office building. Can you describe that experience for them?
It's intimidating for someone who not only has not been in an office building, maybe has never been above four or five stories in their lives. And so now they'll imagine looking out the glass at 51st floor of the Hancock Tower. It's also hard as you're a young person of color going through the security desk. There's often you're going to be looked at a few more times. Someone's going to say, do you really have an appointment here? The reason we were in the Hancock Tower is there was a venture capital firm who let us start in their offices. And they're called Alta Communications. And they heard what we were doing. Their managing general partner, Tim Dibble, he said, what are you trying to do? And I told him, he said, well, why don't you start it here? I've got a few spare desks. So imagine starting a nonprofit on the 51st floor of the Hancock Tower. And as Tim often said, you know, some of our limited partners would come in and see these young adults sitting in the lobby and think, are you running a youth center or a venture capital firm?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gerald Chertavian, the founder of Year Up, an organization committed to narrowing the opportunity divide by providing technical and professional skills to students ages 18 to 24 from disadvantaged backgrounds. The program is 1 year long. Half of the year is dedicated to rigorous training, and the other half involves an internship at a company which pays each Year Up student for his or her work. I'd love to get more of a sense of that first class at Year Up. What about the people who didn't make it through your program?
So the in fact, that first class as well, we two young adults didn't graduate. So we had 20 out of 22 graduate. One young man, he just couldn't get there on time. And so we tried and we tried and we bought the alarm clocks and we called to wake him up. And eventually he fired himself from the program, which is really intentional language we use. He then joined the military, which we thought was probably a good choice because it got him back on track and on time. But he just couldn't adhere to those professional standards. I can think of...
Was that just due to his own motivation or circumstances?
I think that one was his own motivation. Mm-hmm. Another young man, I've worked so hard with, I really did invest probably too much of myself into. And one day he just stopped showing up. Didn't call, didn't show, nothing, just stopped showing up. And we were really worried that something had happened to him. I remember he called me about 6 months later. He said, Gerald, I'm really sorry. He said, can I tell you what happened? He said, I got home one night and no one was there. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, my parents moved, changed the locks, and didn't tell me. And he said, and I just couldn't handle it. And at that point, coming to Europe every day just didn't make a lot of sense for me. And so sometimes the trauma our young people face can be significant and throw them off course. I remember that story really well. I will tell you one story about a young man who was in my backyard the other night for a barbecue. And he was shaking his head as he sat on the bench. He said, I never thought I'd be here. He said, you know, I had unfortunately spent a year of my life in a juvenile detention. And the reason I spent time there is because I protected my mother against my father. That's what landed me in juvenile detention. And I have never before or since been violent, but I couldn't take watching my mom be abused anymore. He said, I never thought anyone would want me after that. He then finished our program, worked at a major financial institution, State Street, currently works at another major financial institution. He manages 15 people. He has his college degree. He has a beautiful son. And so these are incredibly moving stories, not of exceptional. This is not exceptionalism, right? This is not about, wow, a miracle person. This is about if you give someone a chance and an opportunity in this country, they will take it and do well and be your next best employee. Because our young adults don't want handouts. They want hand-ups.
I want to talk about philanthropy for a moment and how you raised funds for Year Up. You mentioned in your book, A Year Up, that you were always frustrated when somebody said to you, a potential donor said to you, you know, it costs $25,000 a year to fund a Year Up student. That seems like a lot of money. What was your response to them?
I often would talk to that person and say, gee, do you have children yourself? And they may say to someone who's 50, 60 years old, so I do. I said, did they go to college? He said, yeah, we had one at Princeton and one at Yale. And I said, oh, so congratulations, really. What a gift and a joy to be able to support your children in those fine institutions. I said, I'm curious, how much did that cost? He said, well, it's about $53,000 a year. I said, oh, did they go for 1 year? He said, no, they go for 4 years. I said, okay, so it's actually like $200,000+. And I said, so why would that not be considered expensive versus spending a tenth of that on a low-income individual who hadn't had the same access and opportunity in their lives? And really get people thinking about who's worthy of investment.
In 2011, through the Clinton Global Initiative, you launched the PTC, which is a professional training corps, which is modeled after ROTC, or ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training. Can you describe what the professional training corps is?
We grew Europe very fortunately from 2000 to 2012 to serve almost 2,000 young people a year. But we then started to think, what would it take to touch 100,000 people? Because the challenge we're trying to address is measured in the millions. It's almost 20% of all young people today in America. So we then started to look at, could we create a program modeled after ROTC, except and put it not in a four-year college, but put it in a two-year college, in a community college, and rather than wear military fatigues, you'd wear business attire. Rather than study Microsoft, rather than study military maneuvering, you'd study Microsoft mouse moves. And rather than go on a field training exercise, you'd go on an internship with a Fortune 500 company.
Given your focus on these two-year community colleges and skills training for young adults, what is your view of liberal arts four-year college system? You know, there's been a lot of debate about that being overrated.
We believe that we're going to see a fundamental rethink of higher education in this country. And it's not an either-or. You know, the reality is, and the statistics would tell us, that the more education you get, the more likely you are to earn more money. So there's a positive correlation there. But if you look at what percent of adults in this country have a four-year degree that they got between the ages of 18 and 22, it's only 8%. So 92% of adults in this country don't have a four-year degree that they got between the ages of 18 and 22. That's an incredibly important statistic, as is the other statistic that half of all the people who go to college today work full-time.
Right.
So what we have to do is expand our view of what is college. And I think with both technology coming into play and how that's affecting and disrupting education and just the need of our economy, we will not recognize higher education in 30 years' time.
In many ways, David was the inspiration for Europe. In what other ways has David been involved in Europe?
David has always been not only the inspiration for Europe, but along the way, he'd be definitely one of my sources of encouragement. And he really taught me a great deal about race, about racism in this country. I can tell you many times when I'd be with David, and we'd be out to dinner at a nice restaurant, someone would come up to him and say, "Hey, here's my keys. Can you get my BMW for me?" And he'd say, "Excuse me?" He'd say, "Yeah, yeah, you're the valet, right?" And so I remember saying to David, "Is this happen all the time?" He said, "Gerald, if I get mad every time that happens, I'd be an angry young man." And it reminds me also the first time I took him to Long Island, and here we're on the beach together in Southampton, and a young boy came up and tried to rub the black off his stomach. And so this young boy probably never been close to a person of color and went up and was touching him to see if it came off.
Your mother was an important person in your life. She died of cancer in 2000. Can you talk about that a little more, if you feel comfortable?
Of course, yeah. So my mom was she had breast cancer. She had metastasized to bone cancer, and she was terminal for about 5 years. And, you know, the best lesson I learned throughout that whole thing is my dad took care of her every single second of every single day. And what it told me, what it showed me was one of my best lessons is when you say in sickness and in health, it actually means something. You know, they were married for, goodness, since 1955 and had had a wonderful marriage. And I remember my dad saying, "You know, Gerald, if the last 5 years are me taking care of your mom while she's in bed, then so be it. I'm going to greet that with a smile." And I tell you, you can take a wedding vow, but when you see it being lived, it's an indelible mark about what those things mean. And I saw that through my dad. My mom was the kind of, if you had a tough mind and a tender heart, you know, my mom was a tender heart. And was very kind, very giving. She would counsel other cancer patients. And I can remember her being on the phone for hours and hours at a time counseling someone who just got diagnosed with breast cancer. The line for her funeral, I swear, was about a mile long. My only sad regret is I decided to start Europe the month after she passed away, so I never get a chance to tell her. My dad always comes to graduations, and he says, "Oh, your mom would have loved this." And I said, oh, she's probably seen it somehow.
By the way, in 1999, before she died, she gave you a clip of a newspaper from Dear Abby. Is that her? So, Gerald, you just showed me a picture of your beautiful mother, and here you are in your wallet carrying this newspaper clipping several years later. Could I ask you to read just a portion of it?
Sure. My mom was a Dear Abby fan, and it was called The Dilemma, and it was about taking risk in life. And it talks about the person who risks nothing, has nothing, does nothing, is nothing. He or she may avoid suffering and sorrow, but he or she can't learn, feel, grow, change, or love. The last line of it says, only a person who takes risks is free. And, you know, it's interesting, Jessica, when I just decided to start Year Up, it was the first time in my life I felt free. Mm-hmm. I can absolutely say it was like when you take off in an airplane, and you know when you first take off, it's bumpy, and then all of a sudden it goes pin drop quiet. It's absolutely silent because you got to a different level of the atmosphere. And that calmness was exactly what I got when I made the decision to start Year Up. I didn't care what anyone thought. Mm-hmm. My wife and I decided it was the right thing to do. We did it, and it certainly made me feel free.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't lose that wallet, Gerald.
I'll try not to, Jessica. It's been with me for 20-odd years. It's staying right in the pocket.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for having me. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Gerald Chertavian, founder of Year Up. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay. Yeah.
We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York, worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern, worked briefly at Soho House, worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres, he's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower, or the the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that, which you just learn about the necessities of life. Food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be, it doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it does.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So I, my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and grew us, raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we've fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? We'd ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of, it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows, and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof you could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence, and it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible, yeah. People go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat. Wow. You know, it's like...
We really just wanted to simplify everything, too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on, and there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean and anything that, any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast. And we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlow & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where you can, that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all of the beans by hand. We took an old piece of, an old grinder or mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for flavor, to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Master Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Master Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Master Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Master Brothers, you know, much to their now ex-wives' dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together, and what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture, or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. You know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other. And the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. And, but that also opens the door to more arguments. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
Right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City. Mm-hmm.
And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from that from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So. And we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, celebrate.
After selling 30 bars at an artist's market.
Like we did really, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do. And that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, that was nice, you know.
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become? Or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory offsite somewhere and all this kind of stuff. And we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth, just like food should be made slowly, with care. A company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you, just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for, A, for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. We were joking. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I've organized, I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you like look through your beautiful pantry of old timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them. You know what I mean? When we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know? So.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.